You're listening to 40 Days of Radical Radio. From Monday, 10th of October, right through to Saturday, the 19th of November, join us on 3CR Breakfast from 8 a.m. until 8:30 a.m. Monday to Saturday as we delve into our rich 3CR archive and bring you half an hour of historical gems. 40 days of historical audio to celebrate 3CR's 40 years of radical radio. In the late 80s and early 90s, Georgia Halleck presented the music program A New Kind of Kick on Friday afternoons between 4 and 6 p.m. In 1990, she interviewed the American countercultural filmmaker John Waters, who was out in Australia as a guest of the Melbourne Film Festival to promote his latest film, Cry Baby.
What was it that propelled you and the motley crew of Dreamlanders back in Baltimore into the filmmaking industry?
Well, I think basically that we were all running from... We were outcasts that didn't seem to mind that. We almost worked at being outcasts. And we all sort of met and then went to downtown Baltimore to sort of find some other kind of life, which was certainly at that point bohemians and beatniks. This was way before hippies. And so I think it was a general boredom, basically, of growing up and being raised that you were supposed to be like everybody else, which none of us believed certainly was the case and sounded like complete horror and hell on earth.
It sounded like dedicated misfits.
Well, yeah, we were, but I don't think we were conscious of it. It wasn't something that was calculated. It was something that happened naturally. It was a group of people that really became support for each other, basically, which all friends are, certainly, only we just went to a little more extremes, I think.
Mm-hmm. So what were the original motives when you picked up that first Super 8?
It wasn't Super 8. I'm too old for that. They didn't have Super 8 then. It was plain 8.
Mm-hmm.
The motive of anything was to make people laugh with a certain sensibility that we had, the sense of humor that we had, that we wanted to spread, like, as my father said, like cancer to other people.
So was it the suburban life, do you think, in Baltimore? Was that the brain damage sort of originally?
Well, we all ran from suburban life. No, I don't think I ever made... Well, in all my movies, I guess if you look back on it, the people that live in suburbia are generally the villains and they're made fun of. We ran from that, certainly, as early as humanly possible. But I never really hung around in suburbia. I mean, I know that the theater where I grew up in my neighborhood eventually played one of my movies, and it said, you know, the neighborhood's own John Waters. And I thought, well, that's really ludicrous. They certainly didn't want to claim me then. I don't know why they want to claim me now.
Of course, that wasn't always the case. How did your fellow Baltimore folk feel about John Waters originally? Right at the start, were they a bit appalled?
There were some that were appalled, but I would say that we always had a following there. We had a censor board that was after us there all the time, that always busted us and made me cut the films in front of them and hand me a pair of scissors and cut them and everything. But generally, I never felt persecuted there, certainly. There was a certain group there that always liked me, and in the really old days, we used to open our films in church basements because... we'd rent the church halls because we figured the police would never bust a church, which was true.
Did they?
No. And the pastors that would let us do it were generally kind of left-wing pastors that figured anything to get these people in a church. So they would let us show even the most blasphemous movies.
That's incredible.
In a church. And I always wanted to, like, pass the collection plate instead of charge admission. They wouldn't let me do that. They did draw the line at that.
Well, what about the films that were around at that time? I can only presume that you were heavily influenced by people like Russ Meyer and Herschel Gordon Lewis and all those classics.
I was influenced by all those in the drive-in movies, but certainly I was influenced by the underground movies, too, which was like Kenneth Anger and Warhol and those people. And at the same time, I was influenced by Bergman and the real arty stuff and the Swedish movies that were supposed to be, you know, the shocking sex movies at the time. And... all types of extreme movies. I mean, nudist camp movies influenced me.
Actually, Herschel made a few of those.
Did he?
Like
that? Oh, yeah, he did make one. I never saw the nudist camp.
They
were
the
better nudist
ones.
Camp movies than Herschel. Yeah. Herschel was better at gore, I think.
I think so, too, most definitely. But suffering from the occasional bouts of misanthropy myself, having viewed your films when I was about 15,
mm-hmm.
I thought, now there's a guy who also has a case of misanthropy. I mean, did you feel that? Were you angry at all?
I guess I was angry, but angry in a way that we used humor as our weapon. You know, we were never violent. Certainly the humor was the deadliest weapon that we had. And I used to say in the same way that the Manson family, maybe why I was interested so much in them, is because we did the same thing, only we wanted to scare the world with a movie camera and not a gun. It was a better career choice.
That's a nice way of looking at it, actually. Maybe someone should have sent Charles Manson a camera.
Well, maybe, yeah. Maybe if they had a camera, they wouldn't have done that, because you just need to channel this lunacy at a certain age. And you know, basically, when I taught in jail, I used to tell the prisoners, these films are my crimes, only I get paid for it, instead of doing time. So
can we look forward to a few John Waters clones coming out of the Baltimore prison system? Is that what's going on?
I don't know if they'll be clones, certainly. But it's I don't know, because all the ones that I like the best have the longest sentences. So I don't know if we can look forward to them coming out, period, much less, I don't know, as how.
Now, I want to talk about the old cast, because I'm a huge fan, in particular, of your early films, mm-hmm. always have been. But the old cast really struck me as, you know, David Devine, mm-hmm. Mink, all those people, mm-hmm. really struck me as being such a dedicated group.
Oh, they were. Certainly, they still are, the ones that are alive. I mean, Mink is in Crybaby.
Yes, of course.
David, unfortunately, David was great. I mean, David I met when I was in high school, and he had silver hair. And he was, he used to just hook school and read Vogue. Which always sort of impressed me, and dye his hair silver, you know. And he knew Devine, certainly, and he was a very early influence. Before Van Smith, who did all the costumes and makeups in my film, David did that also. Certainly Devine's Mondo Trasho outfit, I think David designed. David was great. He was very, very funny. He was very witty, and he unfortunately died in the late 70s from angel dust, a drug that David never even did. I never even knew him doing that. I mean, David didn't have some major drug problem or anything. He did at the end, once he did that drug, but it was very quick. I mean, it was in 6 months or something. And we were estranged for a while there because of that, because I could see that it was killing him, you know. Mm-hmm. And but we weren't at the very end, thank God, you know, that we were friends again. But it was very sad when that happened, you know. And unfortunately, he was one of the first ones, you know. But he was the only one that died really unnaturally, certainly. I mean, Edith died from really old age. I mean, she had...
How old was Edith when she died? 65,
I think. And she died of... what's it when you have too much sugar in your mouth? Diabetes, yeah. And Cookie, unfortunately, died this year of AIDS, which you might not even know.
No, I didn't.
And her husband did also. And Devine, of course, died, you know, from basically being too big. I mean, he went to sleep and just didn't woke up from not being able to breathe correctly, which was horrible, because he died a week after Hairspray opened in New York.
Well, that's right. I'd seen footage of you and Devine at the premiere of Hairspray in Baltimore, and you both looked so proud, and it was just an incredible moment when Devine scratched his name into the cement.
With the mayor there with Devine, you know, and his mother was there. And
surrounded by beehives and teenage Jezebels.
It was very, very nice, you know, and who would have ever thought, I mean, you know, at least he got to experience that, you know, but it's not enough, you know, you work for 40-some years, and then finally things are looking good, and then you drop dead. I mean, I can't think of anything good to say about it. It's, sort of interesting thing at his funeral was pretty incredible, you know. It was like it brought the whole little suburban community that he grew up in to a complete standstill because of the amount of cars and everything, the traffic jams. And what was great was that the priest that was, the reverend that did the eulogy, I did a eulogy, but he did one of them. And he knew Devine when Devine was a little boy, you know, and he gave a very nice one. And he told me
Devine was still Glenn.
Yeah, when he was like 7 and 8 years old. Mm. And later he told me that one of these evangelist priests had called him up and said, how could you bury somebody like that? Do you know what he did in Pink Flamingos in this room? He said, well, theologically, it's not a sin to eat dog dew. Which I thought was a wonderful answer, you know.
That's good.
It's not a set, I don't know if there's any commandments that say, thou shalt not eat dog dew.
No, actually, I don't recall having stumbled on that one. But I'll tell you something, I don't know if you've actually been told this, but in the early 80s when Devine came out to Australia, he was doing his disco act at the time, which incidentally was crazy.
Right.
I attended each show. Unforgettable. But Devine actually made a guest appearance on one of our late night chat shows, a variety show, not the Visage show, before that.
Mm-hmm.
And there was a sort of reactionary tabloid journalist that we have here called Darren Hinch, who confronted Devine on the show and told the audience, and the audience, of course, didn't know who Devine was.
Right.
far as they knew, Divine had a couple of top 40 singles.
Yeah, right.
And Darren Hinch sat there and told the audience, this man has eaten dog do. This man is you know, corrupt, and he's going to ruin our young, and he should be exported.
Oh, that's
should
great.
Be just deported.
That must have been good publicity.
Well, it was. I mean, it made sort of front page at the time. Mm-hmm. This is the early 80s. But
how did Divine react to that?
Well, Divine was very rude, obviously. He sort of said something like Darren Hinch looked like he'd been hit in the face by a bus or something.
Well, that's perfect. I mean, that's a wonder. I'm sure that helped Divine's career. I remember the same thing happened in England when they did something and they tried to ban him from something, and then they did this documentary on us, and they said, oh, it showed cannibalism on television, and we were the cover of one of the tabloid papers, and it just had Divine's picture and the headline, E-C-C-H-H-H, exclamation point. And I really thought it was a great, we were very proud of that.
So you're telling me that, you know, Divine could actually, like, take this sort of criticism, take these people, chewing him out publicly?
Sure, I could. I think Divine basically was probably surprised by that he's doing a talk show and somebody runs out and attacks him. But he basically was smart enough to know that he could use that, and that kind of attention was not going to hurt him, certainly, in any way. It may be in the long run, I think Divine was a little weary of the dog do thing because people asked him about it for 20 years, you know. He never denied it or anything. I think at the end he was weary of it. He was weary of answering the question.
Mm.
Because some people probably never could hire him because of that. They could never get beyond that.
Mm.
They could never realize that that was really a minor thing he did in my films compared to how good of an actor he was. But there were some people that could never, ever get beyond that. And
my parents.
Well, his parents. I mean, my parents, you know, everybody's parents. That's why it was successful. Everybody thought, imagine if my parents saw this.
Yeah, mine did.
No one would want a mother that liked Pink Flamingos.
No, actually, no. That would have been interesting.
I mean,
but, you know, it does seem to me that your cast really did go above and beyond the call of duty. I mean, were there times they said to you, John, I'm not eating any dog shit?
Well, that was the only time ever anything that was real was asked to do.
Okay.
There was sort of, I remember two things that they said no to, and looking back on them, this was also during the Pink Flamingos making of, that I wanted Mink's hair to just catch on fire because it was so red that it burst into flames. And she said, well,
sounds almost religious.
How are you going to do that? And I said, well, we'll light it, and then somebody will throw a bucket of water on you, you know, when we say
like
cut.
Like with hairspray, make it highly flammable.
She said no, you know, and I'm looking back on it, I think she was right. And Cookie also wanted to do a thing. I had a scene where she was supposed to come in and smash a TV set while it was on with a hammer, right? And she called all these places, and they said, don't do it because it'll explode, you know, and she wouldn't do it.
Smart woman.
Yeah. So that's the only thing, and now I look back, I couldn't even believe I asked him to do that, you know? But I certainly wouldn't today, but I don't know. This was an extreme period in our lives.
Well, it must have been extreme because I always swore that, you know, if I ever had the opportunity to interview you, I would ask you this question. I know that in one of the films, I think Mink had to eat some cockroaches, and I know you used real cockroaches for the close-ups, but later on they must have been eating raisins, correct?
Yeah. It was not real cockroaches.
Okay.
The close-up was, I forget, it was raisins. It was raisins. But the long shot was real.
Okay.
Yeah.
So why dog shit? Why not chocolate mousse?
Because we had done that. What would be the point of trying to top eating dog shit by eating roaches? It wouldn't have, there's no punch to that. Because it would be a first and a last in cinema history. No one could imagine that you really did it. It was surreal. It was like, why would you do that? I mean, it was a very ridiculous thing to do. And we did it because I wanted people to leave the theater, and even if they hated the movie, they would have to tell somebody about it. It was probably the most commercial scene I ever filmed. You're still talking about it 20 years later. What film can you think of that somebody's still talking about the end of 20 years later?
True.
So we did it, and it was really no big deal. That's even worse. When I look back on it, I remember the day, and I remember doing it. It was the very last thing of the whole movie.
Didn't you give the dog an enema or something?
Well, yes, we did, because I didn't know if you could say that on Australian radio. I was trying to give you a sanitized version. The true story
is a hardcore
we put the
order.
Dog in, we locked it up for a day and fed it and didn't walk it, right? And it was Pat Moran's dog, right? We all knew the dog. So we followed the dog around for like hours and it wouldn't do it. And we were going to just, Devon was going to eat it no matter where it happened. If a family had been walking by on the street, Devon just would have eaten it right in front of him. And luckily there wasn't anybody there when we did it. But so finally we did give it an enema with a hair dye applicator bottle. A mild enema, you know. I personally didn't, and an assistant did.
Oh, for your art.
And finally the dog didn't divide. So that little one? I said, yeah, go, you know, and he did it. And I can remember looking through the camera and almost shaking from laugh, from just not being believing this was happening. And there was only like, Mary Vivian Pierce was behind me and Danny Mills had played Crackers, and they just started losing it, you know. And Devine just did it, and I said, give me a shit-eating grin, you know, was the direction. And then he did it. I didn't do another take, you know, it was only once. And
I'm noticing you didn't drop the camera. I think I would have.
It was like, I remember it, and it was surreal, is the only thing I can think of. That it was a magic moment, maybe. That right at that moment, all the things came together that were magic in a hideous kind of surreal way. And then we knew the film was over, and Devine called the hospital that night. We had this big party, and he was fine about it. You know, he did brush his teeth with somebody's toothbrush he was having an argument with.
Did he ever get kissed after that episode?
Sure. And, you know, he brushed his teeth, obviously, and then he called the hospital that night and said to the nurse that answered, I have this child that ate dog feces. And the nurse said, is the child retarded? And Devine said, sort of. And we were laughing, like rolling on the ground while he's like has his hand over the receiver. And then the nurse told him, well, the child could get the white worm. And Devine, we heard him say, the white worm. And we lost it. The whole room roared, you know, and then Devine hung up, you know. And it was sort of over, you know. And I've seen it with audiences all over the world, you know. And it always works. That scene always works. More than anything in any film, it works. It gets a reaction of people frightened, actually. And then people run from the theater, and people start laughing, or people start, I've seen people get sick, people cry from it, I've seen like every extreme reaction you can get, people get from that. And we never thought it would go that far. I really never thought we'd be talking about it in 20 years, I know that. It was just one little magic day of our young lives. And I know it'll be the first paragraph of my obituary. No matter what I do for the rest of my life, it will always be in there. I know that. That's fine with me.
You're listening to 40 Days of Radical Radio. From Monday the 10th of October right through to Saturday 19th of November, join us on 3CR Breakfast from 8 till 8:30 a.m. Monday to Saturday as we delve into our rich 3CR archive and bring you half an hour of historical gems. 40 days of historical audio to celebrate 3CR's 40 years of radical radio. And now we'll continue with Georgia Halleck's interview with John Waters.
Well, there were some pretty other crazy things in your films. Nothing
will ever top that.
Shrimping. Now, there's a concept that I wasn't familiar with until...
Shrimping?
I saw it in your films. I mean, shrimping, maybe you could explain what it is.
Shrimping is sucking feet. I know when afterwards my mother saw that movie, she said, how could you think of that? There's no such thing as that. No such thing.
Well, that's what I said.
Now there is, you know.
Well, I know that there is now because I remember reading an article, some Italian guy, someone in Italy was, you know, like sucking feet. No, I haven't. Terribly deprived.
Missing something, you know. You should really get shrimp this weekend.
So how did you catch
safe sex. It's the original safe sex.
The definitive
basically.
Act, I think.
Yeah.
But how did you... How
you
did
could
you...
get athlete's mouth.
How did you cotton on to the concept of shrimping? Where did you first hear it? Confessions of a mad director now.
I think I'll have no comment on that. How did I first hear of it? Let's say it was maybe someone I knew... Well, let's leave it at that. But
on,
I like
John.
The idea of the surrealness of it also. I mean, that it's a ridiculous thing. But certainly I didn't make that up. I had heard about it. I mean, that it is... Freud writes about it. I mean, Freud says that it's a male looking for the female penis, whatever that means. I've never been able to figure out, well, what's that mean? But he claims that's what shrimping is.
It must make you smile that you've actually been responsible for the introduction of these things to people's psyches.
I did not think up shrimping. I mean, you're very naive about shrimping.
Okay.
I think.
So there's veteran shrimpers all over the
world.
Lots of
people have been shrimped and shrimped.
Okay.
There's shrimping porno movies. I've seen them.
Mm-hmm. Okay.
Where people,
please continue.
Can literally, if you're really good at shrimping, it's like deep throat. I mean, they could put the entire foot in their mouth in the one I saw this film.
And what's the title of this
I think
film?
This is selling a lot of tickets. Pardon? I forget the name of the film.
Oh,
you know,
sure.
It was something. No, it was like in part of a porno film, I thought.
I'll give them a plug, John.
Oh, if I would, if I could. You know, I love porno titles. Driving Miss Daisy Crazy, that just came out in America. It did. Screw the Right Thing. The Sperminator, Sperms of Endearment. These are all real porno movies in America.
That's great.
They always take the titles. And
actually, some of the titles that I really love are the old ones, like Hold Me While I'm Naked.
Yeah, well, that's a George Kuchar movie.
On a Hot Tin Roof.
Yeah, but they weren't porno, really. They were underground films. That was the Kuchar brothers who were making wonderful movies, and they still do, too.
Fantastic stuff. Okay, so with the death of Divine, where did that leave you in an artistic sense? I mean, did you think, okay, that's it, close that period of my life where men will dress as women in my movies?
Yeah, I would never use a drag person again. Well, I say that unless maybe I had the Pope or something. You know, if I had somebody really major that I could
who comes in a dress anyway.
He comes in my way. Yeah, I wouldn't do drag again because I really didn't want people to ever think I was trying to replace Divine. He's impossible to replace, so you go on. Luckily, in a way, I hadn't made a movie without Divine before, Desperate Living. So it wasn't like this horrible, I mean, it was a horrible thing because I missed Divine. I liked Divine. I certainly, Divine would have been in Crybaby. Not in any part that's in it now, though. It would have been a different movie because I wrote it after he had already died. So I just, you know, I had to make sure my paranoia was there would be any character that people thought would have been Divine. So I might hear, that's why probably Crybaby is an orphan in it, I think, subconsciously. Because if Divine had been alive, he probably would have been one of the parents.
Well, Crybaby, of course, is a satire of all those, you know, the teenage exploitation films. It's a nice little genre, and it hasn't really been touched for a long time.
No, I don't think it has, because they were almost like jokes then, you know. But they were very innocent. You know, I thought if I could make a really shocking 1954 movie, you would have certainly a comedy in 1990.
Mm.
Like, this movie couldn't have been shown in 1954. It would have been banned, which is pretty amazing when you think now. I mean, a family could go see it without any trouble.
John Waters on a PG rating.
Right. Well, actually, this is PG-13 in America, which is a little more restrictive rating than Hairspray, which was PG.
Mm. Of course.
Both,
you know,
means anybody can go, though. I mean, you know, it's not any restrictions.
No, I can't imagine someone being keen enough but being turned away. But it's also the start of, you know, the boy film. I mean,
mm-hmm. It was the first boy film I made. I remember the first day. The very first shot of the whole movie was actually a scene where Johnny Depp rides up on a motorcycle at the charm school. And I remember thinking, well, in some ways it's the same. You know, that they're both, Johnny Depp and Divine were both males. They were both movie stars. They were good
actors.
I
think that's where the comparison stops,
yeah.
Actually.
And they would have really gotten along. And I took Johnny to Divine's grave. You know, we paid the good visit there. And I think in some ways they were a lot more similar than you would think to me, because they might have been different ends of the masculinity pole, but they were both strong male images.
Hmm. That's something I hadn't thought about. Actually, the first that I heard about Johnny Depp being cast in your film was a kind of sneak report on Entertainment This Week.
Mm-hmm.
And of course, you know, I heard John Waters' film in my ears.
Right.
Kind of went, what? And I thought, Johnny Depp. Has Waters lost his mind? You know, what's wrong? What's going on? You know, I knew Divine shouldn't have died. I knew this would happen.
Well, I think Johnny Depp, to me, did not represent that at all. I mean, because I didn't know that show. I'd never seen it. I watched it then, you know. I just liked his look, and I thought he was a good actor from what people had told me. And when I met him, I knew that he had a really good sense of humor.
Well, the mind boggled. I mean, you know, what you were going to do with him. I had no idea. I thought, you know, this guy seemed so straight. He's, you know.
You thought, even from the show, I didn't think he seemed so straight. I mean, He wasn't. I mean, he was straight sexually, but I mean, you know, I mean, he wasn't. He had a good sense of humor. Nothing really bothered Johnny, and he.
He seemed a bit humor impaired, I thought.
Before.
Before the Waters film.
I think he had that image, and I don't know why exactly, because I think probably from doing interviews that he is not real comfortable with the press. You know, and people that aren't comfortable with the press, they're just nervous about it, so sometimes they come off badly. But Johnny wasn't, he does have a very good sense of humor. I mean, he was very fun to be with. He was never humor impaired. And that's what I figured out the first day we had our meeting. That's why I wanted to hire him. No, Johnny's got a good sense of humor.
That's actually good to hear. And now, having seen Crybaby, of course, I can only agree with you.
He would have never gotten through it. He wouldn't have taken the risk to do the movie if he didn't have a sense of humor. Because it wasn't a safe movie for him to do. He had all these offers to play cops and play movies that were just like Jump Street. Mm. And he chose not to do that because I think he was a little weary of that. Mm. That show just got canceled, you know. He was so happy. Everybody called, congratulations. It was the opposite.
That's great. So, if it hadn't been Johnny Depp, was there anyone else you were looking at for the
label? No, I didn't really have a second. He was my first choice, and he said yes. And I contacted him halfway through writing it. So it wasn't even, you know what I mean? He was part of right from the beginning that I sort of wanted. And I didn't really, I think if it had been somebody else, it might have been an unknown, maybe. Mm. You know, there was no other star I had in mind, certainly not these horrible other ones that are in these teen magazines. I looked through, I'd never heard of them, but they were so ugly.
So do you...
horrible looking children. With drug problems and world opinions and politics. You know, just the worst possible thing that you could ever want to spend 7 months with.
Drug addicts at the age of seven.
Drug addicts with opinions. You know, and too much money. And per diem.
For the female lead role, you used Amy. Mm-hmm. Now, I take it Amy's done all sorts of work, but, you know, she's not the sort of face...
Well, she hasn't done that much. She had done this movie called Wild Angels, and... Lost Angels. Mm-hmm. And then she's now playing Jessica Lange's daughter right at the moment. But she had not done a lot. And actually, I really wanted her right from the beginning, and I had to really convince the studio because they, at first, were not for her. And I think I really like her in it. I think she has that.
What was the problem? Did they want someone more famous?
They thought she was
famous?
Too young. And no, they just thought she hadn't done enough, you know. And that's why I liked her, because she was so young and so innocent that in real life she was. We got her from a Catholic high school a week before graduation, and I had her on the floor of my living room making out with Johnny Depp the first day she got there in rehearsal. And she fainted.
You're kidding.
Uh-huh. Well, I don't blame her, you know, I mean, and you know, that it had to be like, if it was anybody that was more sophisticated, more worldly than that, they wouldn't have gone for either one of those boys, and they would have left the town, so it had to be somebody that, I knew it had to be a Catholic girl.
Mm. And what
they rebelled about.
This is true, I'm one myself. But Iggy Pop, how did you come to meet him? And also, did you write the part of Belvedere with Iggy specifically in mind?
No, I didn't write completely with Iggy in mind. I sort of always wanted to use Iggy. I knew I'd use Iggy for one movie someday, you know. And I had met him just once at a dinner party. But I liked him. And he's my favorite kind of person, a person that has an image of a madman, but in real life is a gentleman. Mm. I don't like real crazy, people that are crazy for real. I like people that can play crazy. It's too hard to make a movie. When you have to get somebody down, bring them to the set with a butterfly net. You know?
And the music of Crybaby is really, it's great to listen to. I just must have moved my head right through the film. And it's so important, sort of amplifying and creating that image of the 50s. How did you go about piecing together the music?
Well, Crybaby, the song, was the very first record I ever bought in my life. And I went through a lot of my records, but I was even a little too young to remember all that, so I went through people whose record collections really were collectors on that, and I would listen to the music in the afternoon and write in the day, and that's how it came about. And then we hired people that knew that kind of music very well, because I wanted the original music to sound like the vintage music.
You've been listening to an interview with John Waters, presented by Georgia Halleck, the host of A New Kind of Kick, a music program presented on 3CR in the late 80s and early 90s. John Waters was out in Australia promoting his latest film, Crybaby, as a guest of the Melbourne Film Festival. You have been listening to 40 Days of Radical Radio. From Monday the 10th of October right through to Saturday the 19th of November, Join us on 3CR Breakfast from 8 till 8:30 a.m. Monday to Saturday as we delve into our rich 3CR archive and bring you half an hour of historical gems. 40 days of historical audio to celebrate 3CR's 40 years of radical radio.